Good afternoon or good evening, depending upon where in the world you are and what time of the day you're listening to this Talking the Blues. No football this week, but I am reminded that at the end of last week's Talking the Blues, which was published on the Saturday, we went into the Sunday in top position, having beaten Brighton, but not expecting to be so because obviously Leicester and Liverpool were due to play their games. But George, tell me, where are we?
Top of the league, mate. Top of the league.
Indeed. How does it feel, Andy?
I'm quite enjoying sitting on these lofty heights.
what an amazing weekend of football last weekend was.
Oh, it was brilliant, wasn't it? The Sunday, particularly. I mean, first of all, for me and our kid, United getting tonked 6-1 was just wonderful. It was like manna from heaven. And then we got.
I don't count that. I'm still furious about Lamella, and the fact that there's been no retribution on him for that kind of behaviour. I mean, obviously United are poor, and I'm really looking forward to them coming to the Carabao Cup. They'll get lit, and that'll be perfect. But he spoilt that result.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously it was clear Tottenham were going to win because United's defence is at the moment nowhere. But
porous,
I'm still furious that he did what he did and nothing happened.
It's even worse that Spurs haven't exactly condemned him for it either. You know, you would
nobody does anymore, Andy. It's part of the game, really.
Well,
would you let your kid do it?
No.
If you were watching your kid playing the under 10s, go to him. That was good, son. That was great when you fell over and got that bent off.
No,
it's... I can't live with it. It's just awful. And somebody ought to have some, you know, have some cojones and say so. Like Hodgson did the other day about ludicrous handball in the match does.
Mm.
When he went, this is just ruining the game. Well, so is Lamella and actions like that, whoever makes them.
Mm.
Oh, sorry, I'm ranting already. Blimey, how long have we been?
Don't worry, we've got more material for you to rant about later.
There's an important point here, that the people that are running the games are not custodians of the game.
They are, but they're not very good ones.
Well, they're custodians of their own interests and their own very narrowly defined interests. So, you know, we can talk about individual players, we can talk about individual football teams, we can talk about the tactics that people deploy, because... And I think, George, you've said this in the past. All of these actions are deliberate. They're not made up on the spot. Somebody doesn't just decide to fake a foul. Somebody doesn't decide just to get their leg in front of the defender's leg when in the penalty area. All of these things are carefully worked out on the training ground beforehand. And it's got nothing to do with the spirit.
I'm afraid that's true.
It's got nothing to do with the spirit of...
So who? When you say custodians, who do you actually mean?
I mean everybody involved in the game, and I could go on a really long rant about this. I mean, the people that run the Premier... Well, the people that run FIFA, the people that run UEFA, the people that run the Premier League. People that run the Premier League are accountable to the people that own the Premier League, which are the 20 teams that are in the Premier League at any one time. The 20 teams that are in the Premier League act as a cartel. They act as a cartel purely in terms of their own interests, their own narrow interests. And those sort of, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 clubs who always think that they're going to be in the Premier League have that first and foremost in their mind. They don't have any interest in football generally, and they don't have, increasingly, they have less interest in the value of the product that they put on the pitch.
I agree with every single bit of that. The only bit that I still go, for what reason they allow the product to be tainted by cheating? What's the point of it? Who gains? Well, I said all this last week.
It's because the difference.
I just do not understand why it has to be morally bankrupt.
Yeah. I mean, the difference between Everton, for example, finishing 12th and finishing 4th and getting into the Champions League, and now fourth place in the Premier League, guaranteed a Champions League group spot. So the difference between finishing 12th and finishing 4th, if you look over two seasons, is probably worth to Everton anywhere between 40 and 60 million pounds.
So you're saying that's the mentality that justifies cheating?
Yeah. And I'm saying what happens is you get one team that starts it and you see that team doesn't get, there's no punishment for the behavior.
Yeah.
And it's incremental.
And
then they look and they say, well, if Spurs can do it, or if United can do it, or if Liverpool can do it, or if Chelsea can do it, whoever the team might be, we'd be stupid not to follow them, because you know there's nothing at all to gain by holding the sort of, you know,
moral high ground
exactly. So then it becomes a race to the bottom.
That would be fine.
Come on.
Yeah, that argument would hold were it not that football is now covered by that Premier League that we all watch is covered by hundreds of cameras, and an action like Lamella's is provable. If the people who own the cartel do not then punish that action in some way, but happily, you know, allow the silly rules not to persist, the whole product is deepened. And I remember the very first podcast we did, and I said this then because it's my idea. This is an idea from a guy I met who was an ex-linesman when they were linesmen, assistant referees. He said, you can stop cheating overnight by docking the club 3 points. If Spurs had come away having won 6-1 and then somebody went, sorry, mate, you just lost points because of him, that would end it. There would be no more. Nobody would risk it. You know, I don't understand why I can't want something that's straight. I don't want to think my cheaters are better than their cheaters.
That comes down to governance then, George, doesn't it? So if you look at how the Premier League is structured, and we'll get onto this when we talk about the £15 decision, you know, the decision for pay-per-view. In order to make any rule changes, 14 of the 20 clubs have to agree to them. At least 6 or 7 of the top 7 or 8 clubs think themselves to be above anybody else in terms of, you know, the structure, what happens, how things are, what things are important to the game, etc. They have no interest at all in changing the game. VAR was brought in to sort of, in one sense, to reduce the impact of cheating, because I think the elements of cheating is so strong in the game that referees can't possibly keep up with it. So if you bring in VAR, then you've got a system which can eliminate it. But there's no evidence to date that it's eliminated anything.
I'm going to say, can you quote me one single example where that's happened yet? I can't.
No.
I could, you know, his toe was offside. His nipple was not in the wrong place. That's not cheating. That's just an accident of physique.
I mean, bizarrely, and this is not a VAR thing, the only person I can think of that has ever been challenged or punished for cheating was Nias. When it was thought that, you know...
Didn't Lanzini at West Ham get done as well a couple of weeks after Nias?
He did, yeah. So there's two examples.
Yeah, the only two, I would suggest. Yeah.
So what do we consider... Or what does anybody... My God, I can't believe this. What did Lamella do? that's not bustable, if you like, not reprehensible, not to be questioned. The other big thing that really upsets me is what are we teaching the children who are watching?
Well, before we get on to that, Arkin, I've just got a question on that.
Sorry, Andy. Like,
No, you're all right. I mean, we all saw Martial flap his hand into Lamella's face, which you cannot do. It was nowhere close to being a punch or a straight arm or anything like that. He just flapped his arm into his face. But you can't do that. So, rightly or wrongly, Martial got a red. And then, as you've said, Lamella went down like he'd been shot, disgracefully. And it just beggars belief. What's gone on in the referees' meetings this week? Because surely the referees have a Zoom conference call every week to discuss the, shall we say, topical moments of the previous weekend. What do we think the referees have said about that? Why aren't the referees and the assistant referee, or linesmen, as we prefer to call them, actually saying, why can't we do something about this? We're the ones who are supposed to be controlling the game, and yet we're letting, we're allowing by default these posers like Lamella to go down and act like a big Jesse. And we've got no option but to send Martial off when actually he didn't do anything that bad. It's not like he balled his fist and give him a black eye.
Well, what's the answer to that question, Andy?
Because
3 weeks
ago,
the controversy handballs. 2 weeks ago, somebody had had a meeting and gone, right, well, we won't have any more handballs for the minute. Will be it. So who made that decision? And why can't a similar decision be made about blatant gamesmanship?
Exactly. Why can't the referees come out and
say...
Did
the refs decide on the Hamill thing?
Well, why can't the referee or the... Why can't the officials' organisation come out and say to the Premier League and the FA and the EFL and UEFA and FIFA and anybody else that they want to say it to, that while we're on the pitch, we see something like that, we will deal with it. And Martial would probably have got his red because he flapped an arm into the face of another player, which he can't do. But Lamella should have got a straight red for posing. And as you said, the moment, it's not as drastic as turning around to Mourinho after the game and saying, sorry, pal, that was a great performance, but we're taking all 3 points off you. We're not giving them United, but you ain't getting them. But if suddenly, the referees, sorry, Jose, if you think that's acceptable, then, you're going to lose a player every week because we're going to bin him. And we're going to bin everyone that we consider to have posed and dived and feigned injury. I mean, we might end up with team, games at 8-a-side, but, they've got to draw a line under this nonsense somewhere.
But the problem with that... Go on, George. No, go on, you make your point.
No, go ahead, mate.
The problem,
no, I know what I'm going to say. I'm interested in what you're going to say.
Okay, the problem with that is the structure and the relationship between the Premier League and the referees' organisation. So all of the Premier League referees are employed by an organisation called PGMOL.
Yeah.
Yeah. PGMOL are funded by the Premier League, the English Football League, and the FA Association.
Right.
Within that organisation, there's a structure that says of the, I think it's something like there's 110 referees and about 180 assistant referees. Within that, there's what's called a select group. And it is only the select group that actually referee Premier League games. And the select group is selected by former referees. Those former referees are paid by the Premier League, by the English Football League, and the Football Association.
Right.
So it's extraordinarily difficult for somebody to take a stance against the direction of travel, because you know we all know, and we've all seen people in the past in our various employment and other things, people who stand up and try and fight against something that they think is wrong, almost inevitably,
bite the dust,
disappear. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what incentive would there be for a referee? You know, just looking at this entirely logically, and I'm not saying that all referees are corrupt or anything else. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying, what incentive is there for any referee to actually say what we're saying as fans, what we're saying as people who love the game of football, actually, we're going in the wrong direction. We need to stamp down on this. We need to stamp down on that. And we need to eradicate that from the game. There's no incentive for them to do so, is there?
I just got thinking about, was it the West Ham game in the Carabao Cup, Arkin, where we all agreed that the referee had had a super game? He'd not flashed any cards around. He'd refereed it sensibly. There was no controversy. And we didn't notice him because he just let the game go ahead. Yeah. All right. Both teams contributed by not doing anything stupid, but he was... he was a shining example of how we'd expect a referee to behave, control the game, but didn't make himself the centre of attention. What I don't recall seeing that guy at Goodison before.
Me neither.
And it just made me, with what Paul's just saying there, what incentive is there for him to get to the top of his refereeing profession if there's almost some unwritten code that, well, we have to do as we're told by our paymasters?
Well, his own personal ambition is the answer to that question, and I wish him all the best. It's almost two separate issues. And you know, the players, you know, obviously respected him and got on with the gig. And West Ham, you know, at 4-1 down, were kicking lumps off people or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But Lamella's action, and you know, the underlying thing behind, every time you hear Shearer speak about how forwards ought to behave in a penalty area, is that it's become institutionalized. And I just find that so sad. And it makes you kind of wonder, at what age do they start teaching it to kids? You know, do the eight-year-old teams do it? To the well, you're 11. That's time to learn how to plunge your centre half's leg, mate. If you want a proper career and you know be popular, you know, I work with a second assistant director once who played for Huddersfield, and he said Warnock was his manager, and Warnock's attitude was if you got a team a penalty, you were out with him that night to a restaurant, and he was paying. Bring your wife. I'm paying. If you got a pen. Not, you know, not if you were hacked down, if you got a pen. If it's that deep in the game, you know, I'm probably wasting my energy.
Mm.
You know, and doubtless, you know, it would be interesting to show Warnock film and go, give me 2 minutes on Lamella's action here.
Mm.
But I think there's two, it sounds like two separate things, really. And I'm... You know, back to what Paul was saying about custodians of the game. I just cannot see the mentality that goes, this would be a worse product if it didn't have cheating in it. Mm-hmm. People will always cheat, but to not punish it, I just do not understand that aspect of what I'm watching.
By not punishing it, you're subconsciously encouraging it.
Of course. Of course, Andy, yeah. That's the whole point.
Yeah.
Which, in a sense, brings us on to what the Premier League have done this week in terms of their response to the situation with regards to
you know,
not being able to show every single game live. So, I think, you know, if we take it back to what happened after lockdown... a compromise agreement was made between the Premier League, BT and Sky, that would allow every single, you know, regardless of the contract that had been signed previously, every single game that was left, the 92 games that were left, would all be shown live either on those two platforms or on the BBC or a couple, you know, a few games on Amazon Prime.
Yeah.
The understanding.
And what's happened now? What?
Well, the understanding with that was that perhaps the early part of the new season, so where we are now, up to where we are now, which was the international break, it was understood through discussions with the government that it'd be very unlikely that spectators would be allowed back in ground. But the understanding was that the government would start to allow spectators back into grounds at the beginning of October. So after round four of all the games have been played, that took the pressure off the requirement to make a decision as to what would happen to those games where no spectators were allowed to attend, but the TV cameras weren't due to be there. The problem arose when the government, for good reasons, turned around and said, well, because of the prevalence and the second wave of COVID, the decision to allow spectators back into grounds from October the 1st, you know, we're no longer going to hold to that. So then the Premier League and BT and Sky are left with in a situation of, well, what do we do? And both BT and Sky have said, because we don't know how long this situation is going to last for, you know, it could well last until March of next year. So the vast bulk of the season, we're not going to put ourselves in a position where, having paid money to show games exclusively on our platforms, we're going to allow either people who don't pay us a subscription to see it for free, or for the BBC or for Amazon who don't pay for this to broadcast it for free as well. So that's the situation that we got into, and then the Premier League are then looking for a response. And the response that the Premier League made, which is a crazy response, is, well, okay, we can solve the problem by any game that was not due to be broadcast can be watched on a pay-per-view basis.
On what channel?
On BT or on Sky. Now, mm-hmm. You don't have to be a BT or a Sky member because it's pay-per-view. And both companies have got the facility to allow you to watch individual games. You know, if you want to watch the boxing, for example, on a pay-per-view basis, Sky already have that channel. And all that would happen is that the games that are not due to be broadcast on the channel would be available on a pay-per-view basis. So the question is, why couldn't the Premier League negotiate a settlement with the broadcasters that would suit the broadcasters? And secondly, in the absence of being able to do that, why on earth do they think it's appropriate to charge £15 to people who possibly have already paid for season tickets and may not have got that money back because different clubs have got different policies in terms of refunding season tickets, and with no acknowledgement at all of the dire economic circumstances that many people are facing, particularly at the end from the end of this month when there's no furloughing? If you're out of work, you're not going to. How can you afford £15 a game if you're out of work?
And if you like, the additional salt in the wound is we've just had the transfer window with oodles more money being spent by the clubs, and now they're going. And I said the salt in the wound is now it's £15 a game. And as someone put it on social media this morning, what's the betting that Sky Super Sunday now becomes the more, shall we say, less attractive games to the mass audience, and all the big games or the, you know, suddenly go pay-per-view? So with no disrespect to either club, the likes of West Brom and Burnley becomes a Super Sunday game, but Monday night, you know, Everton, Arsenal, United, Chelsea, whatever, all become pay-per-view. So the games that more and more people want to watch, you know, they have to pay for on top of their, if they've already got a Sky or a BT subscription.
Yep.
you know.
Crikey. I hadn't, because I've been working this week, I hadn't clocked. I saw the headlines and things, but I think, what does that mean? You know, and I also thought, because I always stream it illegally anyway, which is a bit, you know, naff of me. But I hadn't realised this situation was as blatant as you've just outlined. And can I just ask a question? Somewhere in the middle of all that, Paul, you said Amazon Prime, get it for free. Why?
Well, no, only for that period after the lockdown. So the deal between the Premier League, BT and Sky was that they would allow some games to be free to view on BBC and Amazon Prime. And neither the BBC nor Amazon Prime, they may have paid a small sum for that, but they didn't pay very much. They may have met the broadcasting costs, but they didn't pay, you know, anything like what the commercial value of that match was.
Why not?
Because that was part because that was part of the deal. Part of the deal was, if you want to see it free, that's what you have to do.
You have to sign up to Amazon Prime.
No, you didn't have to sign up to Amazon Prime.
Have I misunderstood this?
The point being that if you were on Amazon Prime, you could see it for free. And there were games that were shown on Amazon Prime after the lockdown that wouldn't have been shown had the lockdown not occurred. So right. Amazon Prime, I don't know what the figure is, would have got, you know, perhaps half a dozen extra games that they could show on their platform free of charge that they hadn't previously agreed to show.
I can't believe we're having this conversation. It's absolutely amazing. I mean, as far as I understand it, Amazon as a company are one of the great tax dodgers of the world, next to the President of the United States. Why on earth is the Billy giving them favours?
Well, never mind that for a minute, our kid. What about the fact that...
Oh, all right.
to watch Premier League football now, other than the games which are already allegedly slated to be shown, it's going to cost £15 a game. Yet the Carabao Cup, which the Everton West Ham game was a pay game because no, it wasn't covered at all, that was only a tenner. So the EFL Carabao Cup is £10 a game, but the Premier League have gone 50% more, £15 a game or £14.95.
Because they can, because people will pay it. There can be no other reason, Andy. They've sat down and gone, how much dare we charge? Somebody's gone, 25 quid, and everybody's gone, give up. I'll never wash that. And they've sat there till they've got to 15 quid and gone, yeah, the sheep will buy that.
Absolutely. Richard Masters said exactly, not quite in the same manner, but he said that the reason why it's 15... The reason why it's £15 against £10 for EFL games is it's a premium product. The other interesting thing in all of this is if you look at the numbers...
Sorry, one thing before you go into that, Paul. In your judgment, both of you, is this the thin end of a wedge?
Yeah, off the top of my head. Because, I mean... I've paid season ticket money to Everton in advance back in February. Okay. So, and Everton have said they'll refund that in three chunks, November, January, and the end of the season. But in the meantime, unless a game is slated for TV coverage, if Everton are on telly and I want to watch it now, I'm going to have to pay 15. So I'm likely to be paying out again before I get a third of my third refunds on the season ticket money I've paid. And it is the thin end of the wedge. And there's people in a lot worse position than me financially, as you said, you know.
Yeah.
You know, who want to watch football and they might not be able to afford to. You know, the counter argument, of course, is that other people are saying, well, you know, if you pay the 15 quid and get three or four of your mates to come round, if they're in your COVID bubble, then you all split the cost and it works out at £2 or £3 a head. Well, that's fine, but we've not all got us football watching mates in our COVID bubbles. So that argument goes out the window. But
it certainly does. Yeah. Family comes first.
Yeah, exactly. But I don't know. It is the thin end of the wedge. And I can see a lot of fans are irate about it. Other people are saying, well, at £15 a game, you'd pay more than that if you went to the game. If you went to the game, even with a season ticket, you're probably paying £25. But we're not going to the game. And what happens if you want to watch 2 or 3 games on a weekend? What happens, there are football fans out there, not specific club fans, people who want to watch football. And they might want to watch the Saturday afternoon, the Saturday lunchtime game, and then the Saturday tea time game, and then the early game on Sunday and the late game on Sunday. If they want to watch those 4 games and they're all pay-per-view, that's £60 for the weekend to watch football. It's ridiculous.
Yep.
Just daylight robbery. You know, at least Dick Turpin wore a mask.
Well, everybody's wearing a mask these days, aren't they?
Yeah, well, yeah, they are because of COVID, yeah.
Can I just ask another question, Paul? I remember from one set of figures that you published at some point, basically the supporters that are not on the grounds anymore, but I think I've got this right, at Everton, I think you said it was something like 17% of the club's turnover, is that correct?
It's not even...
The percentage of money that...
For Everton, it's not even that high. So Everton's last accounts was just over 14 million. On 10 over around about 180 million. So it's around about 8%.
Okay. So what percentage of Everton's turnover was season ticket sales?
Season ticket sales would be about 90% of that. So about 12 million on turnover of 180 million.
You know, I was only thinking that as long as COVID goes on, you know, someone like Andy, next time his season ticket comes around, we'll definitely be going, whoa, just a minute.
Well, perversely,
I don't know. I just wondered how it was going to hit.
The problem for Evertonians, our kid, is that, you know, as and when Bramley Moor Dock is constructed and comes on stream, we all want to be guaranteed the seat we want, and the only way to guarantee that seat is to keep buying season tickets. Where as long as Everton are playing at Goodison.
My God.
So it's short and curly's time, isn't it? They've got us by them. You know, if I want a similar view to my main stand view now, when we get to Bramley Moor Dock,
yep.
I've got to keep renewing my season ticket for Goodison, whether I attend or not, whether they allow fans in or not.
And whether you pay it and then pay the king quid to watch the match, presumably.
Yeah. And by the time we get to Bramley Moor Dock, I'm under no illusion that the price of a season ticket at Bramley Moor Dock is going to be considerably more than it currently is at Goodison. So whichever way you look at it, there's an outflowing of money from my wallet.
Well, what I'm looking at, Andy, what the picture that you're painting, especially with phrases like premier product, is that what, you know, the great classic cliche about English soccer is it was a winning class sport that came out of the pit, is now heading towards being a very middle class sport indeed, where you have to have a bit of handbag to actually watch the damn thing.
Mm-hmm.
As the working class itself gets decimated in numbers because, you know, we don't do industry, we don't do that kind of, we just don't do that kind of workforce anymore in this country. Lots of people working, of course, but you're talking about a seismic shift in the fact that football has now become a rinsing machine. Shirt, mm-hmm. season tickets, pay-per-view, everything.
Yeah.
One of the interesting aspects, and broadly speaking, I think you're right in saying that, George. One of the interesting aspects, though, is that different clubs have taken a different approach over the years to ticket right. pricing. So, for example, Everton, the average amount of money that an Evertonian spends at Goodison Park per game for a ticket is around about £17. That's when you take into
that's
account.
That's really good.
Yeah, that's when you take into account every single person. And one of the reasons why it's so low is, first of all, there's the maximum number of season ticket holders. And secondly, then within the season ticket holders, there's significant numbers of juniors who pay, you know, £5 a match. And there's significant numbers of seniors who pay a reduced amount as well. So that brings the average price down to, as I say, around about £17. If you look at the approach then of other clubs, like the average price at Liverpool, so the amount of revenue that's generated through matchday activities, but divided by the number of people that attend the game, is something around about £57, £58. So, you know, three and a half times greater than it is at Everton. So if you're an average supporter at Liverpool, you spend three and a half times the amount that you would do to watch Liverpool than you would do to watch Everton. United, slightly higher again, around about £60, £62. And Chelsea and Arsenal, the highest, at around about £64. So different clubs have actually taken different approaches.
That is scandalous, man.
I don't have the figure for Tottenham's new ground, but when Tottenham's new ground, the figures are available, that will be even higher. So you're right in terms of, you know, this is an industry that has extraordinarily high costs because it pays its participants huge sums of money. It generates huge sums of money from the broadcasters, but it also generates huge sums of money from ordinary people. And this all goes back.
God, we're in the league and listen to us.
It's a good job we're top of the league, isn't it? This all goes back to point.
No,
my...
but this is shocking. But what you're really saying is it's almost, I don't know what the difference is between amoral and immoral, but there's not a lot of, you know, so actually we've been talking about, to starting with me wrangling on about Lamella, which is an immoral action to make in a game, in a sport. But the whole sport is riddled with it.
Well, I mean, the whole sport is a commercial enterprise.
Yes. I realized the other day that the global, it's a branch of the advertising industry, and it's an incredibly successful one. You know, those ridiculous stories you told about players turning the bottles that they're drinking water around so that the label can be, so they will get the money for advertising those plastic bottles. You just go, oh, for goodness sake.
And the bonus, and the waving to the crowd, you know, bonus.
The solidarity bonus, as it was known.
Oh, dear. But I wonder if they get tattoo bonuses. Oh, no, can't be bothered with it. Dear me.
Can we get back? Can we get back to enjoying the fact that United got tonked 6-1? and then we got
that
served.
Going to go to.
No, hang on a minute. And then we got served up dessert.
Well, did we ever?
What happened? I can't quite remember now.
Liverpool broke COVID rules. They let 7 in. if only that had been us.
Oh, to have been a fly on the wall of that dressing room afterwards. I mean,
in terms of for it being us, you know, the analysis that I watched on MOTD2, which was interesting for once, I don't normally enjoy all that nonsense, but they talked about how vulnerable Everton's high line is, Liverpool's high defensive line is, and that really all you have to do, and they made a point of saying that Mane wasn't there and how good he is at like Ian Rush set up, that thing of defending really early in the game. That you're forever harrying people. But he said that didn't happen. And so the inside forwards, if you like, had time to just pick a pass. And there were four runners running through the Liverpool defence. Well, they've had a fortnight. What do you think we're going to see when we play them? Is it on Saturday or Sunday? It's Saturday, isn't it?
Midday Saturday.
Yeah. What do you think we're going to see? Are they going to, you know, attack us earlier so that we haven't got time to do that? Or are they going to defend deeper? Because, you know, we have got counter-attacking speed.
I think they only know one way to play, don't they?
I tend to err on that side of thinking as well.
So they'll butch up the pressing in midfield to stop people making those passes.
Mm.
Yeah, I'm not a great watcher of other teams, as you know, but I can't recall.
I make an exception when Aston Villa tonk Liverpool 7-2.
No, I'm just saying, you know, and I certainly of the games I do watch, I never watch a game involving Liverpool unless it's they're playing Everton. But from all that I know, all that I've read about them, they only tend to have one way of playing, no?
Yeah. Klopp's got them playing a certain way, and they are pretty effective at it. But it remains to be seen whether they've got a second page to their playbook.
That was the most comprehensive larruping. They're going to have to have done some thinking. I don't know. I'm just curious and can't wait for the match.
But I mean,
can't wait.
Something that we're aware of. Their goalkeeper didn't help matters, did he?
No. Adrian didn't cover himself in very much glory at all, particularly with the first goal.
So you'd have to think that his performance is going to improve.
Mm.
Are they not expecting the proper goalie to be back?
No, he's out for about 3 or 4 weeks, I think, our kid.
Right, okay.
So it's the backup goalie and probably the squad that played at Villa, because they've got a couple suffering with COVID, allegedly tested positive for COVID. Whether they'll be available or not, I don't know, but you wouldn't have thought so, because they shouldn't have been training either.
All right. I suspect you'll find Henderson's back.
Possibly.
You know, set a tempo that they certainly didn't set. I mean, they look so flabby against Villa.
Let's hope it continues.
Good. It was glorious. And,
Because, I mean, while we're talking about what will they have been doing for the last fortnight, you know, let's turn the spotlight back on ourselves. And so far, Ancelotti's got everything spot on this season. We can't imagine that Carlo Ancelotti's just been sat back with his feet up thinking, well, we're unbeaten, we'll be all right. He'll have been working hard this last few days, putting together his game plan for next Saturday.
Yep.
Well, I was just going to make a point a little bit earlier, Andy. Ancelotti's got a very good record against Klopp, hasn't he? I mean,
never lost a home game against Klopp.
Yeah, I mean, tactically, we were superior to them in the one game that he's played since he's come to Everton. You know, in the last derby match, and didn't he do a number on Liverpool? And I don't watch European football, but it was when he was manager at Napoli. Yeah,
yeah. He's never lost a home game against Jurgen Klopp, be it with Dortmund or Liverpool.
You know, and as we said last week, regardless of how Liverpool play, we've demonstrated so far this season an ability to adapt on the situation in the game. So I think we must go into this game very, very confident.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. I mean, you know, watching those highlights, you thought, what is Rodriguez sitting there thinking? I'm gonna, you know, fill your boots time. We'll see. scary. Well, I don't, you know, that thing we were talking about last week about rituals and nerves and do I wear the same shirt and things, I will be well nervous come Saturday. And so high as a kite if we do them. It would be so fabulous for the city and, you know, the blue half of the city, which has suffered long enough. Come on, it would be nice to just turn them over.
Yeah. It'd be amazing if we get 15 points in the first five league games, wouldn't it? Would be tremendous.
What was your wife's prediction, Andy? What was Irene's prediction? 10-0.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Five in each half. Oh, DCL's going to get four. She's just chipped in. And the form he's in, you could actually see that. I mean, scoring on his England debut the other night. I know I said in last week's podcast that I wasn't really bothered about him going to play for England, but I was made up for the lad that not only did he get the start, but he played really, really well.
He did.
And scored. Just superb.
He's a study, that boy, because the improvement is now like year on year, week on week, end on end. And this ability to jump is, he must have worked so hard. He's a fabulous example to any, you know, young football player of either gender or anywhere, whatever, of what you can, how you can improve. He's extraordinary.
Yeah.
That guy who was marking him was 2 or 3, 4 inches taller than him. He beat him to almost every ball just by timing and prodigious height. I wonder if he's been training with a high jump coach.
Well, I want to bring your attention and the attention of listeners to something that I said last week when I compared him to Ronaldo.
You were right. You are right.
In terms of his jumping ability. And no one less than Richarlison made the same comment during the week.
Paul, I hope you've got a T-shirt made. Me and Richarlison were on the same page, mate.
The Esk speaks Richarlison copies.
Yeah, absolutely. Instant Portuguese translation.
I'm only joking, people, if anybody's listening to that. No, but it's true. There was a fantastic DCL's father left a fantastic message on social media. I don't know if you saw it.
Yeah,
saying, you know, how proud he was of his son, of how the fact that, you know, his son was this little boy that he used to take at the age of six.
I've got it here, Paul. I'll read it to you.
Go on. I haven't heard this.
This is word for word verbatim. I remember him not making the England Victory Shield squad at under-16s. Certain coaches and managers not rating him. Having to take a crying six-year-old boy home from his first trial as he was too shy to play. When knocked down, he gets back up. You're not allowed to stay down around here anyway. Rejection is often life's way of directing you to the path you're supposed to be on. If you hang around the barbers long enough, eventually you will get a trim. Travis Binion, David Unsworth, Ronald Koeman, Duncan Ferguson, Carlo Ancelotti, thank you for believing in him when others didn't. The tears shed tonight are happy ones while smiling at anyone who said he'd never make it. Bambi on ice, you said. Bambi found his skates. Dominic Nathaniel Calvert-Lewin, England debut scorer, and reward for the hard yards done. Tonight, Brink belongs to you. Congratulations, son. I love you, and I am beyond proud.
Right, where's the hankies?
Exactly. There's a lot of dust flying around in this living room. Tears welling up. Lovely sentiment.
Yeah, wow. We're all privileged enough to be fathers. Can you imagine how proud one would feel in that set of circumstances?
Oh, crikey, yeah.
Well, you know, I went to watch our middle son teach last time I was in Norway. He said, do you want to come in and just sit in the classroom? So I did, and I felt exactly what that man's just described. My son just surpassing himself in teaching a subject. So, you know, you just sat there thinking, well, I mean, why didn't I have teachers like him? So, yeah, it's very, very recognisable emotion. And Dominic Calvert-Lewin is an extraordinary young man.
Mm. I wonder, I wonder, you know, I read before we started this podcast, I looked on the Everton site and there's an article about Alan and his background, and you know, yep, where he comes from, like, you know, the very poorest parts of Rio de Janeiro. And I just wonder if, you know, there isn't, you know, possibly under Brands in particular, obviously Angelotti as well, why there isn't, maybe there's a, you know, a philosophy to get this type of character into the club, the type of character that, you know, we've been screaming for years.
Mm. Good point, that. Good question. That's a nice question to be able, if we could put that to Marcel Brands directly. Is this one of the character traits you're looking at? Guys who've had to battle and battle and battle through all their junior careers and to get to the top, rather than, you know, be silkily gifted as, you know, early doors and kind of get fast-tracked into a first team.
Well, it goes back to what you were saying last week, Paul, about your theory that one of Ancelotti's great gifts is character study.
Mm. Yep.
That he can see people. You don't have to fight your way out of poverty to be a tough football player. But, you know, that's a mental thing, isn't it? How tough you are. And it's not, you know, but obviously a lot of nurture can help towards it, but it's nature as well.
Yeah, definitely. I totally agree with you. I wonder also whether or not, with Alan being so prominent in this article, whether or not there's not a conscious decision to sort of, you know, put these types of stories out.
Maybe.
Mm. Possibly.
You know, so that we're not just.
You're suggesting there's a concerted media offensive from within the club.
I think if Angelotti is the type of guy that I think he is, he will be influencing these type of things.
Right.
So whereas in the past we would have, you know, nice fluffy stories about somebody doing something in the community, or, you know, something along that basis. Leighton Baines, for example, and I'm not picking on Leighton Baines, but I'm just saying, like, he was the go-to guy when the club wanted to stick something out there.
Yeah.
They were actually sticking stuff out that is, first of all, interesting, secondly, intelligent, and C, actually means something in terms of, you know, how the club and how, in particular, how the team is thinking.
Mm.
Yeah. If you slightly different, but if you look at Sigurdsson's performance in the last few weeks, he's been building and building and building, improving every week. Apparently, I saw the two goals. Apparently, he had a fantastic game for Iceland during the week.
Did he?
Yeah, and he scored two fantastic goals, two fabulous goals from the edge of the area.
I don't know. He just must be so happy. They all must be.
Yeah.
They're hitting, you know, the purple point in their careers. And but for those of them who are a bit later on in years, it must be even sweeter.
I think the amazing thing about Sigurdsson at the moment is he's recently had a family tragedy, hasn't he?
Yep.
His young brother-in-law passed away.
Oh, no.
Surprisingly. So, I mean, that must have been playing on his mind, but it doesn't appear to have affected his game at all. I mean, I'm not suggesting it's prompted a turnaround in form, but his form's been very, very good of late.
It's interesting that one, Andy, because if you recall, before the season started, there was a series of international matches and Sigurdsson dropped out of the Iceland squad before the season started, and he came in for a lot of criticism. Well, a lot of criticism. He came in for some criticism from people saying, oh, you know, is this just an example of him not being bothered about football? When actually it turned out that it was because of the personal circumstances that you mentioned. But since that point, and since the start of the season, you can see his game having come back. In fact, yeah. possibly even gone beyond where it had been previously. And again, we don't know because we're not there, but just thinking about, is Angelotti able to generate this thought process throughout as much of the squad as he possibly can?
Why not? If you plan to seed, you'll catch it off the other players, won't you?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Because the other thing that Alan said, which is really interesting, he was talking about his desire to win. I don't have the article directly in front of me now, but Alan was saying that his wife finds him incredibly annoying because because he never wants to lose anything.
Right.
He always wants to be in first place and he always wants to win. And whilst that's quite a funny story, I just think it's interesting that it's put out there because it's different from the messages that the club have given previously.
Yeah.
And maybe
you're going with that, yeah.
Yeah, maybe the psychology of the club is certainly from a footballing perspective, is turning around. And okay, results generate belief, but you can also generate belief through having a fantastic manager like Angelotti. Also helps bringing in
there's a lot in that, Paul.
Yeah. Also helps.
Good point,
who you've brought into the
continue.
It also helps who you've brought into the changing room as well. So you've got Alan, for example, but I mean they must be turning around and looking at James and thinking, we're in the people that were in the squad last year must be looking at James and thinking we're in a different place here.
Yeah. That's yeah, big good. Time. I mean, we've said it, haven't we? That right now, the confidence within them all as individuals and as a collective must be sky high.
Top of the league, mate.
Yeah, no. Top of the league, quarterfinals of the cup. All going well. It's the turnaround is staggering, and the difference in the mental attitude of those players is chalk and cheese to what it was last year.
And Ancelotti, very, very happy to say, in some detail almost, this is a really simple game.
Mm.
This is not rocket science. This is a simple game.
Yeah. And if he's explaining things and simplifying everything for the players, no wonder they're improving. He's taking all the worry out of them, all the second guessing and over analysis, if you like. Maybe he's just doing away with all that.
Like anything in life, the real experts can explain.
No, but it works. Whatever he's doing works.
Yeah.
Like anything in life, the real experts can explain anything.
Mm.
So if you are a subject matter expert, you make it seem easy. The really clever people in life are the people that can explain complex things easily, because they have a deep understanding of what it is, whatever it might be.
Yeah,
I'm sure Angelotti has got that in spades.
Mm.
Ooh.
Question. We've still got a little time. We've still got a little time with the EFL transfer window. Do we think that there will be any more transfer business involving Everton Football Club in the remaining time? Do we think they're still working hard to try and move some guys out, be it on loan or sales?
I'm sure they're trying, but
how long have they got, Andy?
Is it till next weekend, Paul?
Yeah, the latter part of next week. I think the 15th.
Right. Yeah, 15th.
Yeah.
Right.
So we've got a few four or five days to maybe try and move four or five players as I said, either on loan or in permanent deals. I personally don't see any more incoming, so I'm hoping that we're able to move a few on to reduce the wage bill and trim the squad to the numbers that Ancelotti said he's comfortable working with, which is 25.
I think it's going
to
be.
Does that 25 mean that unless somebody gets a broken leg and definitely can't complete the season, that those, does he nominate those players and then those players have to, as best they can, complete the season? Is that how it works?
No. No, he's just saying that his optimum, the optimum size for him to manage is 25.
But Everton have access to more than that if things go a bit pear-shaped, injury-wise.
We've currently we've got 28 now. We had 31.
Yeah.
All right.
And if you look at the names that we could add to the back page of any match day programme with a first-team squad, you can probably have more than that because we've currently got, you know, likes of Ellis Sims, and some of the other youngsters have all got squad numbers, but are they seriously going to play? Probably not. Like I said, my question was just, you know,
it would be nice if we could move Bezic and Bolasie and people that one assumes Ancelotti is not that concerned about.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, just for the, I mean,
right,
from the business side of the club, to take those players off the wage bill, either partially by a loan or entirely by a sale, would surely benefit the club. And you know, no disrespect to those players, we don't have to worry about them then. You know, there's Tosin and. I don't know. I just kind of hope that there's, you know, one or two departures. Well, that killed that.
Well, for their sakes, really. Yeah. Because they're not going to pay.
Well, Angelotti's already said that about Bolasie, hasn't he?
Yeah.
He wasn't so specific about Bezic, but, you know, clearly he doesn't fit into the plans. So they're the two obvious ones. I guess, you know, both their contracts are up in June 2021. Mm-hmm. It's a question of whether or not, how much they want to play football in between now and then.
Mm. Yeah.
Because financially, they're not going to be in a better position going elsewhere.
You wouldn't have thought so, no.
Not, you know, even if we decide to contribute towards their wages. So, interesting one.
Mm-hmm.
That must make a very interesting dynamic round the dinner table. You know, domestically, I can sit here and not play, and yet, you know, the year for a football player is so finite. Of course, there are players who play on for a long, long time, but not high energy performers. I don't know. It's just a very strange conundrum to be dealing with, that amount of money makes to a life.
Yeah. To be fair, I don't know their individual circumstances, but I suppose if you're getting towards the back end of your career, there are other considerations as well. Perhaps by that time you've got a family, perhaps you've got young children in school. So, you know, if you're settled in the Northwest, perhaps you don't want to move. So I don't think it's just...
Very good point, Paul.
Yeah, I don't think it's just about playing football. If you've got a young family, perhaps then there's other considerations as well.
Mm.
We've covered the under, guys.
Pardon?
What, is that George? Has George disappeared?
Has he gone?
It's cutting out, so there's long silences here that I can't interpret as to whether none of us are talking or you can't hear me.
Okay, I'll check.
We heard that. Is this your way of backing out of a quiz, our kid?
Is this what?
Is this your way of backing out of a quiz?
I'm always happy to miss a humiliation, Andy, yeah.
So have we got a quiz or are we finishing?
I don't know. Have you got a quiz? I haven't got a quiz.
Me, I haven't got a quiz. Irene has.
I was waiting for Irene, yeah.
10 questions
about Everton. Yeah. Go on.
Which 6 players have scored 30 or more Premier League goals with Everton FC?
Did you hear that?
I didn't hear the last 3 words in the Premier League.
Yeah, come on, come on. Which six players have scored 30 or more Premier League goals with Everton?
In a season or in total?
No, in total. In total. Well, that'll be all Lukaku. Right.
Tim Cahill.
Cahill, yeah.
Cahill. Yeah. Richarlison.
No.
No.
Osman? Leon Osman? No.
Oh, yes, sorry, yeah.
Yeah, Osman, yeah.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Well done, Irene.
Well, who else is there?
Duncan Ferguson.
Duncan Ferguson.
David Unsworth.
David Unsworth, ooh.
And Kevin Campbell.
Wow.
Kevin Campbell. Have we forgotten it? We must have done. Right, next question.
Hang on. If Campbell's in that list, why isn't Lineker?
Lineker didn't play Premier League with Everton.
All right.
Premier League was 1992. Lineker was 86.
All right. Oh, blimey.
Yeah, long time ago. Question 2, hang on.
Which 4 players won 30 or more caps for England with Everton?
Which 4 players won 30 or more England caps with Everton? Jagielka.
Phil Jagielka.
Yeah.
Baines.
Yeah. Baines, yeah.
Is this current players?
Is this Premier League?
Is this overall time? Oh, Bawley. Alan Ball. Yeah.
Ray Wilson.
Yeah.
Ray Wilson, yeah. That's it. Next.
Question. Which 4 Everton players were part of England's 1986 FIFA World Cup final squad?
Which 4 players? You got that?
Stevens, Reid and Lineker.
Correct.
Come on.
Yeah.
Sounds like a bunch of solicitors.
Go ahead.
Which 8 players have worn Everton's number 5 shirt in the Premier League era?
Right. Do you get that? 8 players have worn the number 5 shirt in the Premier League era.
Keane.
Right. Michael Keane, yeah.
Yeah.
Jags.
No, Jags was 6.
Samuel Eto'o.
Samuel Eto'o, yeah. Samuel Eto'o wore 5.
Johnny on.
A bit slow.
Johnny on Lescott.
There it is.
Yeah. John Stones.
Yeah.
Yeah. Johnny on Lescott.
Yeah, John Stones.
Who did you say, Paul?
Johnny on Lescott.
Johnny on Lescott. Yeah. Johnny Heitinger.
Yeah, good one, Andy.
Dave Watson.
Dave Watson.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How many more?
Kirk Zouma.
Kurt Zouma.
Class, Paul.
Two more.
Keane.
We've had Keane.
What's his name? Williams, the guy from Swansea.
Oh, yeah. Ashley Williams. Yeah. Yeah. One more.
Holgate?
No.
Weir.
David Weir.
That's it.
David Weir. Very good. Next question.
Oh, wow.
Which 8 goalkeepers?
Oh, flipping heck.
Wore the Everton number 1 shirt in the Premier League.
8 goalies who've worn number 1. Pickford.
Yeah.
Neville Southall. Martin. Nigel Martin.
He didn't. He didn't. Number one, was he?
No.
Tim Howard.
No. No, Tim Howard didn't wear one.
Thomas Myers.
Thomas Myers.
Yeah.
Yeah. Richard Wright. Yeah. That's four.
Jan Mokka.
Jan Mokka. Yeah. Five. Carlo Nash. Yes.
Come on, Andy. Well done.
Have you had Gerard?
No. Gerard, well done.
One more.
One more. One more goalie.
So we've got Southall, Meyer, Gerard, Wright, Nash. Mucker, Robles.
Robles. Yeah. Well done.
Oh, well done.
Next question.
Which six 2014 FIFA World Cup finals players were affiliated with Everton?
Did you get that?
Rodriguez.
Rodriguez. James. No, James. It's James Rodriguez. You'll read it as.
No, well, that's not it.
No. 2014. In 2014. Yeah. Oh, right. Not. Flipping heck. Who did we have?
Yeah. Rooney.
Rooney. No, shaking of the head.
So let's think about this. Leighton Baines.
Baines, one.
Jagielka.
Jags. Yeah. Lescott. No.
Ross Barkley.
Ooh.
Barkley, yeah.
Rodwell? No.
Jack Rodwell? No.
Tim Howard for the US.
Tim Howard for the States.
Shout, Paul.
Well, Landon Donovan, no.
That means
no.
Cahill for the Aussies.
Cahill for the Aussies. No.
No.
Lukaku for Belgium.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm going to go for Kevin Morales.
Yeah.
Morales. Well done. Oh,
class, man. Class.
I think everybody will have switched off by now. It's just the three of us. There's four of us playing.
Question 7. Four questions to go.
Oh, flipping it. Come on, then.
Which 8 Premier League players of the month won with Everton?
8 Everton players have won Player of the Month in Premier League.
Oh, my God.
Well, DCL's...
Lukaku.
Lukaku.
Yeah.
Jagielka.
Jags.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because he won it with David Moyes, the same.
Cahill. Though. Tim Cahill. Arteta. Howard. Baines. Southall.
James Beattie.
Who?
James Beattie.
James Beattie. Andy Johnson.
Yes, Andy Johnson.
Andy Johnson, yes!
Well done.
Oh, dear.
Good quiz.
Jags, who said it. Is that only we've only got three?
You've got five to go.
Five more to go, hopefully, next.
Oh, my God.
Wayne Rooney.
Rooney?
No.
No. Didn't know we had that many good players.
We've had Calvert-Lewin, yeah?
No, we don't. We can't. It's only just this month. This is pre this month.
Okay. Marouane Fellaini?
Fellaini? Yes. That's four.
Jelovic?
Nikita Jelovic? No. No.
Pienaar?
No. Pienaar? Yeah, come on.
Duncan Ferguson.
Duncan Ferguson?
Andy Johnson.
Andre Kanchelskis.
Kevin Campbell again.
We keep forgetting him.
Andy Johnson.
Yeah, we've got Andy Johnson.
Nikita.
We said that, Nikita Jelovic.
Oh, did you? Sorry.
Yeah. There you go. Quizmaster's on the blink here.
Don't have a domestic.
Right, next question. We're in an overtime here.
Right. Which five players scored six or more goals for England while with Everton?
We're going way back, apparently. It's all time.
Gary Lineker.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dixie Dean.
Yes.
Tommy Lawton.
Yes.
Joe Royal.
No.
No.
Alan Ball.
Sorry, who did?
Dixie Dean, Tommy Lawton, yeah. Lineker, Bawley.
Yeah.
That's four. We've got one more. Rooney.
Yeah.
Yes. Next question.
Two to go. But there was no ball.
Quick.
What was unusual about the 1985 FA Cup semi-finals between Everton and Luton and Man United and Liverpool?
Did you hear that? What was unusual about the both of all the managers were English?
Yeah.
Yeah, we had that one.
Yeah, we had that one a few weeks ago. Don't worry. Last question.
How many times have Everton finished above Liverpool in the Premier League?
How many times have we finished above the Reds three. In the Premier League?
I think it's three.
Three times.
Can
you say when? Which season?
Yesterday, today, and tomorrow.
Good one, our kid.
2005.
Yeah.
Yeah.
2000. Didn't we do it twice on the run? So did we do it in 2006? No, we didn't do it in 2006 because we were rubbish.
2004.
2008, nope. 2009.
No. Nope.
2012, 2000.
12-13.
Okay.
Bobby Brown shoes.
All right, that's it. Thank you, dear.
That was brilliant, Irene.
You know, they're looking for a replacement to Sue Barker.
Say again?
They're looking for a replacement to Sue Barker.
Question of sport. She couldn't cope with Phil Tufnell.
He's gone as well. All right, guys. Arlene, thank you very much for your guest appearance. George and Andy, thank you. We had a good old match at the beginning of it. Then we realised that we're top of the league and we realised we're going to beat Liverpool next weekend. And then we finished off with a good quiz. So what is there not to like?